snap, chock full of vitamin C. I planted the tree about 2 feet from where I buried Daddy. I thought it would be nice if he had some shade. 2 days later, it was dead, and the apples tasted like mentholated cigarettes, liver and onions, and cheap fucking rum. I was standing on my father's grave in the mud underneath the water spray meant for the potatoes. From there I could see the whole farm from front to back. The rows of fruit trees, separated by color, light to dark, lemons, apricots, pomegranates, plums, satsumas, figs, pineapples, avocados. The fields, which rotate from corn to wheat, then to Japanese rice, if I feel like paying the water bill. The greenhouse sits in the middle, backed by leafy processions of cabbage, lettuce, legumes, and cucumbers. The grapes on vines along the south fence, tomatoes on the northern, then the white blanket of cotton. Cotton that I haven't touched since my father died. What was it Hominy said to me when I first started popping off about bringing back Dickens? You heard the saying, you can't see the forest for the trees. Well, you can't see the niggers for the plantation. Who was I kidding? I'm a farmer, and farmers are natural segregationists. We separate the wheat from the chaff. I'm not Rudolf Hess, P.W. Botha, Capitol Records, or present-day U.S. of A. These motherfuckers segregate because they want to hold on to power. I'm a farmer. We segregate in an effort to give every tree, every plant, every poor Mexican, every poor nigger a chance for equal access to sunlight and water. We make sure every living organism has room to breathe. Hominy.
Yes, massa.
What day is it?
Sunday.
Why? You going down to Dum Dum's?
Yeah. Then ask that bitch nigga where my fucking Little Rascals movie's at.
Chapter 19. Attendance was light, maybe 10 people. Foy, unshaven and draped in a wrinkled suit, stood in the corner, twitching and blinking uncontrollably. Foy had been in the news lately. His out-of-wedlock children so numerous they'd filed a class-action suit against him for the emotional distress he'd caused by sticking his face in front of a camera or microphone at every opportunity. At this point, it was only the smooth, Euclidean, planar perfection of his box cut and his Rolodex that was holding both him and the dum-dum donut intellectuals together. Hard to lose faith in a man who even at the worst of times can keep his hair on point and call upon friends like John McJones, a black conservative who'd recently added the Mick to his slave name. McJones read from his latest book, Mick, Please. The Black-Irish Journey from Ghetto to Gaelic. The author was a good get for Foy, and with the free Bushmills, there should have been more people, but there was no doubt the dum-dum donut intellectuals were dying. Maybe the notion of a cabal of stupid black thinkers had finally outlived its usefulness. I'm in Flingo, a small artist hamlet on the northern coast of Emerald Isle. McJones was reading. His lisp and faux white enunciation made me want to punch him in the face. The All-Ireland Hurling Championship is on the telly. Kilkenny versus Galway. Men with sticks chasing a small white ball. A round-shouldered bloke in a fisherman's sweater stands behind me, gently tapping the butt of a shillelagh into the palm of his hand. I've never felt more at home. I copped a seat near King Cuz, who was playing the back as usual, munching on a maple bar and leafing through a stray issue of Lowrider magazine. When Foy Cheshire spotted me, he tapped his Patek Philippe like I was a deacon walking in late to church. Something wasn't right about Foy. He kept interrupting McJones with meaningless questions.
So, hurling... That's also college slang for vomiting, am I right?
Seeing as he wasn't using it, I borrowed Cuz's copy of The Ticker. In the fiscal quarter since the Wheaton Academy's inception, employment in Dickens was up 1/8. Housing prices had risen 3/8. Even graduation rates were up a quarter. Finally, black people were in the black. And though it was still early in the social experiment, and the sample size was relatively small, the numbers didn't lie. For the past 3 months, since the Wheaton Academy went up, the students at Chaff Middle School were performing considerably better. Not that anyone was going to be skipping any grades or putting in an appearance on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire anytime soon, but on average, the scores on the state proficiency exams were approaching, if not mastery, a promising competency. And as near as I could make out from the state guidelines, the improvement was such that, in all likelihood, the school would not be going into receivership, at least not any time soon. After the reading was over, Foy strode to the front of the room, clapping like an enthusiastic child at his first puppet show. "I'd like to thank Mr. McJones for that stimulating reading. But before we get into this afternoon's subject matter, I have an announcement. The first is that my latest public access show, Black Checker, has been canceled. The second is that, as many of you know, a new battle has begun, and the enemy dreadnought is right here offshore in the form of the Wheaton Academy, which is an all-white school. Now, I have friends in high places, and they all deny the existence of the Wheaton Academy. But fret not, I have developed a secret weapon." Foy dumped the contents of his attaché case onto the nearest table. A new book. Two people immediately got up and left. I wanted to join them, but remembered I was there for a reason, and part of me was insanely curious as to what American classic Foy would bastardize next. Before passing it around the room, Foy coyly showed the book to John McJones, who shot back a look and said, "Nigga, you sure you want to unleash this shit on the world?" When it reached the back, King Cuz handed it off to me without even looking at it, and as soon as I read the title, I didn't want to let go. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. It dawned on me that Foy's written works were black folk art, or is it folks art, and were going to be worth something one day. I was beginning to regret the book-burning thing and that I hadn't started a collection, because I'd spent the past 10 years looking down my broad black nose at probably now impossible to find first and only edition titles like The Old Black Man and the Inflatable Winnie the Pooh Swimming Pool. Measured expectations. Middle March, middle of April, I'll have your money, I swear. On the cover of Tom Sawyer, a preppy black boy wearing penny loafers and argyle socks, exposed by a pair of flooding whale print lime green pants, and armed with a bucket of whitewash, stood bravely in front of a wall splashed in gang graffiti, while a pack of ragamuffin hoodlums looked on menacingly. When Foy snatched Tom Sawyer from my hands, it felt like I'd fumbled away a game-winning touchdown catch. "This book, I'm not ashamed to say, is a WME, a weapon of mass education." Unable to contain his excitement, Foy's voice rose 2 octaves and took on a Hitlerian fervor. "And just as he inspired me, the character of Tom Sawyer will galvanize a nation to whitewash that fence, to cover up those frightful images of racial segregation that the Wheaton Academy represents. Who's with me?" Foy pointed at the front door. "I know these great African-American heroes are down with the cause." Legally, I'm not allowed to say who Foy name-dropped, because when I turned my head toward what I thought would be Foy's invisible hallucinations, standing in the Dum Dum Donuts doorway were 3 of the world's most famous living African-Americans. The noted TV family man, blank I, blank blank, blank blank blank, B blank, and the Negro diplomats, blank O, blank 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 O, blank blank blank, and blank N, blank 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 E, E blank blank blank, blank blank C blank. Sensing the Dum Dum Donut intellectuals were dying, Foy had pulled out all the stops and called in who knows what favors. Somewhat surprised, the crowd was so small, the three superstars cautiously sat down, and to their credit, ordered coffee and bear claws and participated in the meeting, most of which was spent with John McJones regurgitating the usual Republican Party bullshit that a child born into slavery in 1860 was more likely to be raised in a two-parent household than was a baby born after the election of the USA's first African-American president. McJones was a snobby Negro who covered up his self-hatred with libertarianism. I at least had the good sense to wear mine on my sleeve. He went on to cite statistics that, even if true, were completely meaningless when you consider the simple fact that slaves were slaves. That a two-parent antebellum household wasn't necessarily a bond of love, but a forced coupling. He didn't mention that some two-parent slave marriages were between sister and brother, mother and son, or that during slavery, divorce wasn't really an option. There was no, "I'm going out for cigarettes and never coming back." What about all the two-parent households that were childless because their kids had been sold off to who knows where? As a modern-day slave owner, I was insulted that the venerated institution of slavery was not given the viciousness and cruelty which it was due. "What a load of crap," I said, interrupting McJones with a schoolboy raise of the hand. "Like you wouldn't rather be born here than in Africa. See, blank, blank, blank. N, blank, blank, W, blank, blank, blank," snapped back, with a streetwise inflection that belied his curriculum vitae and his V-neck sweater. "What, here?" I pointed at the floor. "Like in Dickens?"
"Well, maybe not a hellhole like Dickens," McJones said,
giving the other guests a "don't even bother, I got this" glance.
"Nobody wants to live here. But you can't even pretend to tell me that you'd rather be born in Africa than anywhere else in America."
"You'd rather be here than in Africa," the trump card all narrow-minded nativists play. "If you put a cupcake to my head, of course I'd rather be here than any place in Africa. Though I hear Johannesburg ain't that bad, and the surf on the Cape Verdean beaches is incredible. However, I'm not so selfish as to believe that my relative happiness, including but not limited to 24-hour access to chili burgers, Blu-ray, and Aeron office chairs, is worth generations of suffering. I seriously doubt that some slave ship ancestor, in those idle moments between being raped and beaten, was standing knee-deep in their own feces, rationalizing that, in the end, the generations of murder, unbearable pain and suffering, mental anguish, and rampant disease will all be worth it because someday my great-great-great-great-grandson will have Wi-Fi, no matter how slow and intermittent the signal is. I said nothing and let King Cuz do my fighting for me. In 20 years, I'd never heard him say anything in a meeting more substantive than acknowledging the fact that the iced tea could use more sugar. But there he was, facing off with a man with 4 advanced degrees who spoke 10 languages, none of them black except French.
"Nigger, I refuse to let you impugn Dickens like that,"
Cuz said sharply, standing up and pointing a freshly manicured nail at McJones.
"This is a city, not a hellhole."
Impugn? Maybe 20 years of dum-dum donuts rhetoric hadn't all gone to waste. To his credit, McJones, despite Cuz's tone and size, didn't back down.
"I may have misspoken, but I must take exception to your implication that Dickens is a city, when it's clearly a locale. Nothing more than an American shantytown. A post-black, post-racial, post-soul flashback, if you will, to a time of romanticized black ignorance."
"Hey. Look, fool, save that post-soul, post-black bullshit for somebody who gives a fuck, 'cause all I know is that I'm pre-black. Dickens, born and raised. Homo sapiens OG Crip from the goddamn primordial giddy-up, nigga."
King Cuz's little soliloquy seemed to impress Miss R. blank, 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 because she uncrossed her ankles, opened her legs just enough to show off some right-wing inner thigh, and then tapped me on the shoulder. That big motherfucker play any football? A little running back in high school. My trusike mokre, she said in lip-licking Russian. I'm no linguist, but my best guess is that it meant Cuz could penetrate her secondary any time he wanted. The old veterano strode into the middle of the donut shop, the rubber soles of his canvas sneakers squeaking with every step.
This, you proudly uncool motherfucker, this is Dickens.
And to some beat that only he could hear, he broke into the complex gangster soft shoe known as the Crip Walk. Never turning his back to the crowd, he pivoted on the balls and heels of his feet. His knees together and his hands free, he skipped around the room in tight concentric circles that collapsed upon themselves as quickly as they expanded. It was as if the floor was heated and too hot for him to step in one spot for even a second. King Cuz was debating with McJones the best way he knew how. Want some? Get some. Bad enough? Take some. Velis aliquam, aquiris aliquam, caninus satis, capis aliquam. As the sparse crowd gathered around the two foes, I did what I came to do. I removed my daddy's picture from the wall and tucked it under my arm. Segregating the city with his photo up would be like having sex in the room next to your parents' bedroom, not being able to concentrate, not being able to be as loud as you wanted to be. I quietly dipped out as King Cuz was teaching McJones, blank, 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 L, C, blank, 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 Y, blank, 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 N, P, blank, 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 and a dreamy-eyed blank, O-N-D, blank, 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 ZZ, blank, 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 E, the Crip Walk. And they were picking it up like pros, strutting around like old-school bangers. It figures, because passed down from the Maasai and stolen from the Cherokee war dances you see on old westerns, the Sea Walk is an ancient warrior dance, one that designates its baggy pants, danseur nobel, as target. It's a dance that says, you may fire when ready, Gridley. And any nigger in the limelight, even those conservative shills, knows what it's like to have the bullseye play squarely on your back. I was untying my horse when Foy placed a father figure arm around my shoulder. There was an uptight and nervous look to his goatee that I'd never seen before. His neck was caked with dirt, and a deep stench of body odor wafted over me. You... riding off into the sunset, sellout? I am. Long day. That crap about being better off under slavery is too much even for you, isn't it, Foy? At least McJones cares. Come on. He cares about black people like a seven-footer cares about basketball. He has to care because what else would he be good at? Knowing I was never coming back to the dumb-dumb donut intellectuals, Four gave me the same sorrowful look the missionaries must have given the jungle heathen. A look that said, it doesn't matter if you're too stupid to understand God's love. He loves you regardless. Just hand over the women, the distance runners, and the natural resources. You're not worried about that all-white school?
No. White kids need learning, too.
But white kids aren't going to buy my books. Speaking of which... Foy handed me a copy of Tom Sawyer, then signed it without me asking him to.
Foy, can I ask you something?
Sure.
I know it's probably urban myth, but is it true that you own the really racist Little Rascals movies? Because if you do, I can make you an offer.
Apparently, I touched a nerve. Foy shook his head, pointed to his book, then lumbered back inside.
As the glass doors opened, I could hear King Cuz, the nation's wealthiest black man, and two legendary Negro ministers plenipotentiary rapping the lyrics to N.W.A.'s Fuck the Police at the top of their lungs. Before placing Tom Sawyer in the saddlebag, I read the inscription,
which I found vaguely threatening. To the sellout. Like father, like son. Foy Cheshire.
Fuck him.
I galloped home. Drove the horse hard down Guthrie Boulevard, inventing some inner-city dressage along the way as I ignored the traffic cop and ran the horse through a series of figure eights by dashing in and out of the orange construction barrels in the shut-down center lane. On Sheraton Avenue, I latched onto a tiring skateboarder and with one hand on the reins pulled her along like a longboard cabriolet from Airdrome to Sawyer, whipping her into a sharp turn onto Burnside. I don't know what I expected from trying to restore Dickens to a glory that never existed. Even if Dickens were to one day be officially recognized, there'd be no fanfare or fireworks. No one would ever bother to erect a statue of me in the park or name an elementary school after me. There'd be none of the head rush Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable and William Overton must have felt when they planted their flags in Chicago and Portland. After all, it wouldn't be like I founded or discovered anything. I was just brushing the dirt off an artifact that had never really been buried. So when I arrived home to Hominy, he excitedly unsaddled my horse, eager to show me some newly disambiguated entry in an online encyclopedia written by some anonymous scholar. Dickens is an unincorporated city in southwest Los Angeles County. Used to be all black. Now there's hella Mexicans. Once known as the murder capital of the world, shit ain't as bad as it used to be. But don't trip. Yes. If Dickens ever became a real place again, in all likelihood, Hominy's wide smile would be all the reward I'd ever receive. Chapter 20. Keep this under your hat. But over the next few months, the resegregation of Dickens was kind of fun. Unlike Hominy, I've never had a real job. And even though it didn't pay, driving around town with Hominy as the African-American Igor to my evil social scientist was sort of empowering, even though we were mocking the notion of being powerless. Monday through Friday, at exactly 1 o'clock, he'd be out front standing next to the truck. Hominy, you ready to segregate?
Yes, massa.
We started small, Hominy's local fame and adoration proving invaluable. He'd soft-shoe his way inside, bust out an insanely intricate song-and-dance routine from old Chitlin Circuit days that would have made the Nicholas Brothers, Honey Coles, and Buckin' Bubbles green with blackface envy.
"'Cause my hair's curly, just because my teeth are pearly, just because I always wear a smile, like to dress up in the latest style. 'Cause I'm glad I'm living, I take these troubles all with a smile. Just because my color's shady, makes no difference, maybe, why they call me shine.'"
Then, as if it were part of the act, he'd stick a colored-only sign in the storefront window of a restaurant or beauty shop. No one ever took them down, at least not in front of us. He'd worked too hard for it. Sometimes in homage to my father, if Hominy was on his lunch break or asleep in the truck, I'd enter wearing Dad's white lab coat and carrying a clipboard. I'd hand the owner my card and explain that I was with the Federal Department of Racial Injustice and was conducting a month-long study on the effects of racial segregation on the normative behaviors of the racially segregated. I'd offer them a flat $50 fee and 3 signs to choose from: black, Asian, and Latino only, Latino, Asian, and black only, and no whites allowed. I was surprised how many small business people offered to pay me to display the no whites allowed sign. And like most social experiments, I never did the promised follow-up. But after a month was up, it wasn't unusual to get calls from the proprietors asking Dr. Bonbon if they could keep the signs in the windows because they made their clientele feel special.
The customers love it. It's like they belong to a private club that's public.
It didn't take long to convince the manager of the Maralta, the only movie theater in town, that he could cut his complaints in half if he designated floor seating as white and non-talkers only, while reserving the balcony for blacks, Latinos, and the hearing impaired. We didn't always ask permission. With paint and brush, we changed the opening hours of the Wanda Coleman Public Library from Sunday through Tuesday, closed, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5:30, to Sunday through Tuesday, whites only, Wednesday through Saturday, colored only. As word started to spread of the success Charisma was having at Chaff Middle School, every now and then an organization would seek me out for a little personalized segregation. In looking to reduce the youth crime rate in the neighborhood, the local chapter of Un Millar de Muchachos Mexicanos, or Los Emes, wanted to do something other than midnight basketball. Something a little more conducive to the Mexican and Native American stature. A sporting endeavor that didn't require a lot of space where the kids could compete on equal footing. Name-dropping the hoop success of Eduardo Najera, Tani Robinson, Earl Watson, Shoni Schimmel, and Orlando Mendez Valdez did nothing to dissuade them. The meeting was brief, consisting of two questions on my part. First, do you have any money? We just got a $100,000 grant from Wish Upon a Star. Second, I thought they only did things for dying kids.
Exactly.
During the height of the government enforcement of the Civil Rights Act, some segregated townships filled in their municipal pools rather than let non-white kids share in the perverse joy of peeing in the water. But in an inspired act of reverse segregation, we used the money to hire a lifeguard who posed as a homeless person and built a whites-only swimming pool surrounded by a chain-link fence that the kids loved to hop, so they could play Marco Polo and hold their collective breaths underwater whenever they spotted a patrol car passing by. When Charisma felt that her students needed a counterbalance to the onslaught of disingenuous pride and niche marketing that took place during Black History and Hispanic Heritage Months, I came up with the one-off idea for Whitey Week. Contrary to appellation, Whitey Week was actually a 30-minute celebration of the wonders and contributions of the mysterious Caucasian race to the world of leisure. A moment of respite for children forced to participate in classroom reenactments of stories of migrant labor, illegal immigration, and the Middle Passage. Weary and stuffed from being force-fed the falsehood that when one of your kind makes it, it means that you've all made it. I took about 2 days to convert the long out-of-business brushless car wash on Robertson Boulevard into a tunnel of whiteness. We altered the signs so that the children of Dickens could line up and choose from several race wash options. Regular whiteness, benefit of the doubt, higher life expectancy, lower insurance premiums. Deluxe whiteness, regular whiteness plus warnings instead of arrests from police. Decent seats at concerts and sporting events. World revolves around you and your concerns. Super deluxe whiteness. Deluxe whiteness plus jobs with annual bonuses. Military service is for suckers. Legacy admission to college of your choice. Therapists that listen. Boats that you never use. All vices and bad habits referred to as phases. Not responsible for scratches, dents, and items left in the subconscious. To the whitest music we could think of, Madonna, The Clash, and Hootie and the Blowfish, the kids, dressed in bathing suits and cutoffs, danced and laughed in the hot water and suds. Ignoring the amber siren light, they ran under the waterfall of the not-so-hot Carnauba wax. We handed them candy and soda pop and let them stand in front of the drying blast of the hot air blowers for as long as they wanted, reminding them that having a warm wind blowing in your face was what it felt like to be white and rich. That life for the fortunate few was like being in the front seat of a convertible 24 hours a day. It wasn't necessarily a case of saving the best for last, but as Hood Day approached, Hominy and I had managed to install some form of segregation in nearly every section and public facility in Dickens, except for the Martin Luther Killer King Jr. Hospital, which is paradoxically located in Polynesian Gardens. Polynesian Gardens, a.k.a. PG, being a majority Latino neighborhood that carried a rumored reputation for being hostile toward African Americans. In fact, local legend had it that the injuries black Dickensians suffered while driving through PG to the hospital were often more severe than the afflictions that had caused them to seek medical attention in the first place. Between the police and the gangs, navigating the streets of any neighborhood in L.A. County, especially any section not familiar with you, can be dangerous. You just never know when you're going to get rolled up on for being or wearing the wrong color. I never had any problems in Polynesian Gardens, but if I were to be honest, I never went there at night. And the evening before our planned action on the hospital, there'd been a shootout between Vadio Polynesian Gardens and Barrio Polynesian Gardens, two gangs with long-standing blood feud over spelling and pronunciation. So to ensure Hominy and I got in and out with our asses intact, I attached two small purple and gold Lakers pennants to the front fenders of my pickup truck, and for good measure flew a giant Iwo Jima-sized 1987 championship Lakers flag from the roof. Everybody, and I mean everybody in Los Angeles, loves the Lakers. And driving down Centennial Avenue, even behind slow-moving lowriders that refused to go faster than 10 miles an hour, the Lakers flag billowed majestically in the night wind, giving the pickup truck an ambassadorial vibe that allowed us to cruise through with a temporary diplomatic immunity. The director of Martin Luther Killer King Jr. Hospital, Dr. Wilberforce Mingo, was an old friend of my father's and had given me permission to segregate the place when I explained to him that it'd been me who painted the border lines, put up the exit sign, and conceived the Wheaton Academy. He leaned back in his chair and said that for 2 pounds of cherries, I could segregate his hospital in any way I saw fit. And under the cover of No One Gives a Fuck Darkness, Hominy and I painted the words, "The Bessie Smith Trauma Center," in thick, drippy, blood-red horror movie poster letters on what was until then a nameless glass door emergency entrance to King Hospital. Then we drilled a plain, black-and-white metal placard into the middlemost concrete pillar. It read, "White-owned ambulance units only." I can't say I did this without trepidation. The hospital was the one large-scale place I'd segregated where there was a decent likelihood that outsiders would see my work. Scared to proceed inside, I asked Hominy to hand me one of the fresh carrots I'd picked the night before. "What's up, Doc?" I teased, nibbling on the carrot tip. "You know, Messer, Bugs Bunny wasn't nothing but Brer Rabbit with a better agent." "Did the fox ever catch Brer Rabbit? Because I'm pretty sure the white boy's gonna catch us after this one." Hominy straightened the Sunshine Sammy construction sign on the side of the truck, then grabbed the paint cans and two brushes from the back. "Messer, if any white people do come through here and see this shit, they're gonna think what they always think. These niggas crazy, and carry on about their business." A few years ago, before the internet, before the hip-hop, the spoken word poetry, the Kara Walker silhouettes, I'd have been inclined to agree with them. But being black ain't what it used to be. The black experience used to come with lots of bullshit, but at least there was some fucking privacy. Our slang and debased fashion sense didn't cross over until years after the fact. We even had our own set of top-secret sex techniques, a Negro Kama Sutra that got passed down on the playground, the stoop, and by drunken parents intentionally leaving the door open just a crack so the little niggas might learn something. But the internet proliferation of black pornography has given anybody with a $25 a month membership pass or a lack of regard for intellectual property rights access to our once idiosyncratic sexual techniques. And now, not just white women, but women of all creeds, colors, and sexual orientations have to suffer through their partners humping them at a mile a minute and yelling, "Who owns the pussy?" every two strokes. And even though they've never fully appreciated Basquiat, Kathleen Battle, and Patrick Ewing, and still haven't discovered Killer of Sheep, Lee Morgan, Talcum Powder, Fran Ross, or Johnny Otis, these days, mainstream America's nose is all up in our business, and I knew eventually I was fucking going to jail. How many pushed me through the automatic doors?
Massa, no one gives a fuck about the hood until they give a fuck.
Hospitals don't have the rainbow of directional lines anymore. In the days of butterfly bandages, sutures that didn't dissolve, and nurses without accents, the admitting nurse would hand you a manila folder and you'd follow the red line to radiology, the orange to oncology, the purple to pediatrics. But at Killer King, sometimes an emergency room patient tired of waiting to be seen by a system that never seems to care, and holding a plastic cup with a severed finger swimming in long-since melted ice or staunching the bleeding with a kitchen sponge, sometimes out of sheer boredom they'll slip over to the glass partition and ask the triage nurse, "Where does that brackish-colored line lead to?" The nurse will shrug. And unable to ignore the curiosity, they set out to follow a line that took Hominy and me all night to paint, and half the next day to make sure everyone obeyed the wet paint signs. It's a line that's as close to the yellow brick road as the patients will ever get. Though there's a touch of cornflower blue in the shade, Pantone 426C is a strange, mysterious color. I chose it because it looks either black or brown, depending on the light, one's height, and one's mood. And if you follow the 3-inch-wide stripe out of the waiting room, you'll crash through 2 sets of double doors, make a series of sharp lefts and rights through a maze of patient-strewn corridors, and then down 3 flights of filthy, unswept stairs until you come to a dingy inner vestibule lit by a dim red bulb. There, the painted line pitchforks into 3 prongs, each time leading to the threshold of a pair of unmarked, identical double doors. The first set of doors leads to a back alley, the second to the morgue, and the third to a bank of soda pop and junk food vending machines. I didn't solve the racial and class inequalities in health care, but I'm told patients who travel down the brown-black road are more proactive. That when their names are finally called, the first thing they say to the attending physician is, "Doctor, before you treat me, I need to know one thing. Do you give a fuck about me? I mean, do you really give a fuck?" Chapter 21. It used to be that to celebrate Hood Day, Kang Cuz and his latest crew, the Coliseum Boulevard et tu Brute Gangster Munificent Neighborhood Crips and Shit, would roll into the territory of their archenemies, the Venice Seaside Boys, caravanning down Broadway Street, 4 cars and 20 fools deep, the sun at their backs, looking for action. For most of them, unless they were being carted off to jail, it was the one time during the year they left the neighborhood. But since the advent of the variable-rate home loan, most of the VSBs have been priced out of their turf by wine bars, holistic medicine shops, and edgy movie stars who've erected 15-foot-high cherrywood walls around quarter-acre bungalows turned to $2 million compounds. Now, whenever the vast majority of the Venice Seaside Boys want to put in work and defend their turf, they have to commute from faraway places like Palmdale and Moreno Valley. And it's no fun anymore when your enemy refuses to fight back. Not for lack of bravery or ammunition, but from fatigue. Too tired from fighting 3 hours of freeway traffic and road closures to pull the trigger. So now, the two once rival hoods celebrate Hood Day by staging their version of a Civil War reenactment. They meet at the sites of the great battles of the past, fire blanks and Roman candles at each other, while innocent sidewalk cafe civilians duck and run for cover. They pile out of their hot rods and hoopties, and like frat boys playing a rough game of two-hand touch in the mud, the misbegotten sons of the West Side chase each other up and down the Venice Beach boardwalk, paying homage to the rumbles of old by squabbing, throwing blows from the shoulder, as they act out and relive the gang fights that changed history. The Battle of Shenandoah Street, the Lincoln Boulevard skirmish, and the infamous massacre at Los Amigos Park. Afterward, they meet up with friends and family at the rec center, a demilitarized softball field in the middle of town, and reaffirm the peace over a barbecue and beer. Unlike all the police departments who credit zero-tolerance policies for every dip in the crime rate, I don't want to simply assume my 6-month campaign of localized apartheid had everything to do with the relative calm Dickens experienced that spring, but that year, Hood Day was different. As Marpesa, Hominy, Stevie, and I plied our trade from the visitors' dugout, we were running out of fruit slices much quicker than usual. People were overpaying for eighths. Normally, each gang, each hood, uses the park on the day designated to rep their hood. For instance, the 6 Trey Street Sniper City Killers reserve the park for June 3rd, because June is the 6th month of the year, and Trey means 3. Los Osos Negros 12 y 8 have dibs not on December 8th, like you might expect, but on August 12th, because contrary to popular belief, California is cold as fuck in winter. I was at the rec center on that balmy March 15 because for the Coliseum Boulevard et tu Brute Crips, Hood Day is the same day as the Ides of March. When else would it be? Back in the late 80s, before the word hood had been appropriated to refer to any location from the upscale enclaves of the Calabasas Hills, Shaker Heights, and the Upper East Side, to a student zoo at your state university, when a Los Angeleno mentioned the hood as in, "I'd watch that motherfucker if I were you, he or she's from the hood," or, "I know I didn't visit Abuela Silvia on her deathbed, but what'd you expect me to do? She lives in the hood." It referred to one place and one place only, Dickens. And there, on the rec center baseball field, congregated under the Hood Day banner slung over the home team dugout, were gang and family members of all colors and stripes. Since the riots, Dickens, a once unified neighborhood, had balkanized into countless smaller hoods. And now, like Yugoslavia in reverse, Kang Kuz and Panache, the erstwhile Tito and Slobodan Milosevic of the city, were celebrating the reunification by tromping across the makeshift stage in their Oakley sunglasses, their Doris Day perm curls bouncing off their broad shoulders as they rapped fiendishly to the beat. I hadn't seen Panache in years. I didn't know if he knew Marpesa and I were sleeping together. I never asked for permission. But seeing him do his signature stage tricks with Lulu Bell, his pump-action 12-gauge equivalent to B.B. King's guitar, which, considering that like some criminal-minded baton twirler he could throw high in the air, catch, reload, and blast a hubcap out of the air like a clay pigeon, all with one hand, maybe I should have. Kang Kuz yelled into the microphone, "I know at least one of you niggers had to have brought some Chinese food." Two dudes, whom the police and anyone else with a street-smart IQ of 50 might refer to as suspicious Hispanic males, stood at the first baseline just outside the festivities, their arms folded across their chests. Although they looked more or less like everyone else at the park, from the way they eyed everyone with such disdain, it was hard to tell if they were from Dickens. Like Nazis at a Ku Klux Klan rally, they were comfortable ideologically, but not in terms of corporate culture. Word spread that they were from Polynesian Gardens. Nevertheless, the irresistible smell of hickory-smoked barbecue and the cloud of dank billowed over them, drawing the duo farther and farther into the infield. When the men arrived at the on-deck circle, Stevie, who was slicing the pineapples with a machete, asked, "You know them niggas?" Never taking his eyes off the two homies as they made their way down the dugout steps. Both dudes wore khakis, whose baggy leggings spilled over 2 pairs of Nike Cortez sneakers so fucking new that if they had taken one shoe off and placed it to their ear like a conch shell, they'd hear the roar of an ocean of sweatshop labor. Stevie exchanged prison stares with the guy in the bucket hat, football jersey, and stomper stenciled along his jawline. In the hood, men don't wear sporting club jerseys because they're fans of a certain team. The color, the logo, the jersey numbers all mean something gang-related. When you're fresh out of lockup, everything is racial. It's not like there aren't Mexicans in predominantly black, Crip, and blood sets, and blacks in mostly Latino cliques. After all, on the street, it's all proximity and propinquity. Your alliance is to the homies and to the hood, regardless of race. Something happens to the identity politics in prison. Maybe it's like movies, where it's white versus black versus Mexican versus white, no ifs, ands, or buts. And I do hear tell of some hardcore colorblind thugs who roll into lockup and dance with the niggas or the vatos who brung them. Fuck La Raza. Chinga black power. This nigga's mother used to feed me when I was hungry, so later for the stupid shit. The fool in the ice cap white t-shirt and puppet tattooed vertically down his gullet nodded to me first.
¿Qué te pasa, pelón?
Us fellow baldheads don't share in all the racial animosity. We've come to accept that regardless of race, all newborn babies look Mexican, and all bald-headed men look black, more or less. I offered him a hit of my joint. His ears turned deep red, and his eyes glazed over like Japanese lacquerware.
What the fuck is this, dog? Puppet coughed.
I call it carpal tunnel. Go ahead, try to make a fist. Puppet tried to ball his hand, but failed. Stomper looked at him like he was crazy, then angrily took the joint from his hand. I didn't need a program to tell me that despite appearances, Puppet and Stomper weren't on the same side. After a long puff, Stomper twisted his fingers into all sorts of dexterous gang signs, but he couldn't knuckle up, no matter how hard he tried. He removed his nickel-plated gat from his waistband. He could barely grip the gun, much less pull the trigger. Stevie laughed, and it was cold pineapple slices all around. The homeboys took bites, and the unexpected surge of sweetness with a slightly minty finish caused them to wince and giggle like little kids. Then, to the hard glares of the other hoodlums, the two cholos walked into deep center field, calmly scarfing down pineapple and sharing the last of the marijuana. You know that NK on Johnny Unitas's neck don't stand for nice kid.
I know what it stands for.
Stands for nigger killer.
Both them niggas from different sets, though. Barrio PG and Vario PG. Not like them to be chilling like that. Hominy and I shared a smile. Maybe the signs that we'd posted in Polynesian Gardens on the way home from the hospital job were working. We'd made two signs, hammered them into two telephone poles on opposite sides of Baker Street, where the rusted train tracks divided the neighborhood between Vario and Barrio PG. We placed them in such a way that if folks on one side of the street wanted to know what the sign on their side said, they'd have to cross the tracks to read it. So they had to venture into enemy territory, only to discover that the sign on the north side of the street was exactly the same as the one on the south. They both read, "The right side of the tracks." Marpesa pulled me out of the dugout and toward home plate. Cancuz and a delegation of aging thugs and wannabes were standing in the batter boxes, grubbing on ribs and pineapple. Panache was chewing his pineapple slice down to the rind, telling stories about a musician's life on the road when Marpesa interrupted him.
I just want you to know I'm fucking Bonbon.
Oblivious to the thorns, Panache stuck what remained of the pineapple skin and all into his mouth, slurping and sucking out every last drop of juice. When the fruit was dry as a desert bone, he walked up to me, tapped my chest with the tip of Lulu Bell's barrel, and said,
"Shit, if I could get some of this pineapple every morning, I'd fuck the nigga too."
A gunshot rang out. In center field, Stomper, apparently still feeling the effects of the carpal tunnel, was barefoot, lying on his back, aiming the gun with his feet, laughing his ass off and shooting with his toes at the clouds. It looked like fun, so most of the men and a few women went to join him, puffing on their joints, weapons out, and hopping through the dirt infield, one shoe on, one shoe off, hoping to spark a few rounds before the cops came. Chapter 22. Black people pop. Pop being Hollywood slang for having a dynamic camera presence, for being almost too photogenic. Hominy says it's why they rarely shot black and white buddy movies anymore. The biggest stars get washed out. Tony Curtis, Nick Nolte, Ethan Hawke does a film with some African-American, and it becomes a screen test to see who's really the invisible man. And has there ever been a buddy movie featuring a black woman and anyone? The only ones with the cinematic magnetism to hang were Gene Wilder and Spanky McFarlane. Anyone else, Tommy Lee Jones, Mark Wahlberg, Tim Robbins, is just hanging on to the mane of a runaway horse. Watching Harmony at the L.A. Festival of Forbidden Cinema and unabashedly racist animation on the Newark big screen, trading one-liners with Spanky, it wasn't hard to see why back then all the trades thought he'd be the next big pickaninny. The sparkle in his eyes, the gleam in his cherubic cheeks were magnetic. His hair was so kinky and dry, it looked as if it might spontaneously combust. You couldn't take your eyes off him. Dressed in raggedy overalls, wearing black high-top sneakers 10 sizes too big, he was the ultimate prepubescent straight man. No one could take it like Harmony. It amazed me how he withstood the onslaught of uncensored and unforgiving watermelon and my daddy in jail jokes, welcoming each insult with a heartfelt and throaty yowza. It was hard to tell whether he was demonstrating cowardice or grace under fire, because he'd perfected that bug-eyed, slack-jawed, dumbfounded look that to this day passes for black comedic acting chops. But the modern-day black entertainer has to do it only once or twice a movie. Poor Harmony had to pull off the coon reaction shot 3 times a reel, and always an extreme close-up. When the lights went up, the host announced that the last living little rascal was in the house and invited Harmony on stage. After a standing ovation, he wiped his eyes and took a few questions. When talking about Alfalfa and the gang, Harmony's incredibly lucid. He explained the shooting schedule, how the tutoring worked, who got along with whom, who was the funniest off-camera, the meanest. He lamented how no one ever notices Buckwheat's emotional range and rhapsodied about how much his mentor's speech and diction improved in the MGM days. I kept my fingers crossed that no one would ask about Darla, so I wouldn't have to hear about a take-five reverse cowgirl under the bleachers in Football Romeo. We have time for one more question. From the back, directly across the aisle from me, a group of black-faced co-eds stood in unison. Dressed in Victorian bloomers with the Greek letters Nu Iota Gamma stitched across their chests and their hair haphazardly set in thick plaits with wooden clothespins, the women of Nu Iota Gamma looked like dolls you'd see at an antiques auction. In unison, they tried to ask a question.
We wanted to know.
But they were beaten back by a chorus of boos and a hail of paper cups and popcorn containers. Harmony hushed the audience. The room grew silent, and as it turned its self-righteous attention back to him, I noticed the woman closest to me was African-American, the tininess of her ears giving her ethnicity away. It was a rare sighting on Sunday afternoon, a true female coon, black as 70s funk. Black as a C-plus in organic chemistry. Black as me.
What's the problem?
Harmony asked the crowd. A tall, bearded white boy in a fedora a couple of rows in front of me stood up and pointed a finger at the line of sorority topsies.
They are in non-ironic blackface, he said defiantly. That's not cool.
Harmony shielded his eyes with his hand and peered blindly into the audience and asked,
Blackface? What's blackface?
At first, the audience laughed. But when Harmony didn't crack a smile, the guy stared back at him with a doltish, wide-eyed look of bewilderment, not seen since the days of great buffoons like Step and Fetch It and George W. Bush, the first coon president. The white dude respectfully called Harmony's attention to some of the films we'd just seen. Sambunctious, where Spanky pours ink on his face and pretends to be Harmony so his dusky friend can pass the spelling test and join the gang on the school trip to the amusement park. Black Rascalion, where Alfalfa dinges up
so that he can audition to be the lead banjo picker in an all-Negro jug band. Jigaboo, where Froggy turns the tables on a ghost by stripping down to his skivvies and covering himself from head to toe in fireplace soot, shouting, "Booga booga boo!" Hominy nodded his head, laced his thumbs and his suspenders, and rocked back on his heels. Then he proceeded to light and smoke an invisible cigar, which he switched from one side of his mouth to the other.
"Oh, we didn't call it blackface. We called it acting."
He had the audience eating out of his hand again. They thought he was being funny, but he was dead serious. For Hominy, blackface isn't racism. It's just common sense. Black skin looks better, looks healthier, looks prettier, looks powerful. It's why bodybuilders and international Latin dance contestants blacken themselves up. Why Berliners, New Yorkers, and businessmen, Nazis, cops, scuba divers, Panthers, bad guys, and kabuki stagehands wear black. Because if imitation is indeed the highest form of flattery, then white minstrelsy is a compliment. It's a reluctant acknowledgement that unless you happen to really be black, being black is the closest a person can get to true freedom. Just ask Al Jolson or the slew of Asian comedians who earn their livings by acting black. Just ask those sorority girls who are settling back into their seats, leaving the lone black member to fend for herself. Mr. Hominy, is it true? Does Foy Cheshire really own the rights to the really racist Little Rascals movies?
Damn.
Don't get this nigga started about that Foy Cheshire bullshit. I stared at the black-faced woman in blackface, wondering if she, too, was acting, if she felt free, if she was aware that the natural color of her skin was actually blacker than her black face, meaning, technically, she was in somewhat lighter than blackface. Hominy pointed me out in the crowd, and when he introduced me as his master, a few heads turned around to see what a real live slave owner looked like. I was tempted to tell them that Hominy meant to say manager and not master, but I realized that in Hollywood the two words amounted to the same thing.
I believe it to be true, and I believe my master's gonna get them back for me, so that one day the world will see my best and most demeaning and emasculating work.
Thankfully, the house lights began to dim. The racist cartoons were starting. I like Betty Boop. She has a nice body, is free-spirited, loves jazz, and apparently opium, too, because in a hallucinogenic short titled Ups and Downs, the moon is auctioning off a Depression-era Earth to the other planets. Saturn, an old bespectacled Jewish orb complete with bad teeth and a heavy Yiddish accent, wins and rubs his hands greedily.
"I got him. I got him the whole world, mein Gott,"
he gloats, before removing gravity from the Earth's core. It's 1932, and Max Fleischer's metaphorical Jew is making an already chaotic global situation even worse. Not that Betty cares, because in a world where cats and cows fly and the rain falls up, priority number one is to keep your skirt line from ascending to the heavens and exposing your form-fitting panties. And who's to say that Miss Boop isn't a member of the tribe? For the next 60 minutes, a few drunken, droopy-feathered Native Americans fail to catch the Warner Brothers rabbit, much less assimilate. A Mexican mouse tries to outwit the gringo pussycat so he can sneak across the border and steal the queso. A seemingly endless lineup of African-American cats, crows, bulldogs, maids, crapshooters, cotton pickers, and cannibals act a gravelly-voiced Looney Tunes fool to the strains of Swanee River and Duke Ellington's Jungle Nights in Harlem. Sometimes a shotgun blast or dynamite explosion turns a nominally white character like Porky Pig into a gunpowder-colored minstrel, bestowing upon him honorary nigger status, which allows him to sing merry melodies like Camptown Races over the closing credits with impunity. The program ends with Popeye and Bugs Bunny taking turns single-handedly winning World War II by flummoxing buck-toothed, four-eyed, gibberish-speaking Japanese soldiers with giant mallets and geisha subterfuge. Finally, after Superman, supported by gongs and a cheering audience, pulverizes the Imperial Navy into complete submission, the lights come back on. After 2 hours of sitting in the dark laughing at unmitigated racism, in the brightness, the guilt sets in. Everyone can see your face, and you feel like your mother caught you masturbating. Three rows in front of me, a black guy, a white guy, and an Asian guy,